We've been considering a psalm, one written by Dode. And it is the reason for this, by the way, was that we are trying to present Yahweh's position on his Torah, on his plan of salvation, on his testimony, so that when Paul calls it pornographic, when Paul says that it's incapable of saving, when Paul says that it's an old system that was cruel and that it enslaves, we can see what God had to say by contrast, which is the antithesis of that. So it's sometimes difficult to recognize a liar until you compare the liar's words with the truth. So we are contemplating Yahweh's testimony regarding his plan for relationship and salvation, so that we understand that when Paul contradicts it, that he is obviously lying. Now, we had turned to the 40th Psalm, and it is telling that this is written by a deeply flawed individual. Now, the concept that Paul proposed for Christianity was that no one could meet all of the demands of the Torah, and therefore, if they failed, and when they failed, since it was obvious they would fail, in meeting any one of the Torah's obligations, that they would be doomed and convicted of it, and therefore guilty, and therefore going to die. Unfortunately, that premise is completely negated by the author of this psalm. He has told us that he has more flaws, more departures from the Torah than he has hairs on his head. That he was a scallywag. And so to have an individual who has clearly violated the Torah, not once, but countless times, be the author of psalms, songs that teach us how to benefit from the Torah and to be saved by it, completely negates the entire premise of Pauline Christianity. Now, it's interesting that when Yahweh introduces us to his spokespeople, to those he engages with, those he works through in the Torah, they're all flawed. I mean, you look at Abraham. Abraham lied about his relationship with Sarah all to keep his head attached to his shoulders. You know, he knew that she was, I guess, hot stuff. She must have been a good looker. Because when they left the promised land, Israel, to go into Egypt during a drought, he knew that she was so attractive that Pharaoh would want him for himself. And he said, you know, if she is known to be my wife, then Pharaoh would have me killed to have access to him. So we're going to go in and we're going to promote a lie that she's my sister. And Pharaoh caught him on the lie. And then it happened again another time where he took that same tactic. He was a flawed individual. And yet he's the individual that Yahweh established the covenant relationship with, someone that Yahweh said, you're vindicated. Because the covenant is for flawed individuals, to vindicate them, to empower them, to improve them, to help them grow. Then you move even to the story of Lot, which was Abraham's nephew. And Yahweh said, listen, I'll engage to save a singular individual from Lot if there is a righteous individual. I said, okay, you know, the best we got there is Lot and his family, and they were scallywags. I mean, you look at Lot, the first thing that he does when Yahweh's messengers appear is says, you know, you better come in and because you're really good looking, and they'll try to rape you here. You ought to come in and we'll hide you in my house. And when people knock on the door and say, hey, who are those hot dudes that came into town? We want at them. We want to have our way with them. He says, no, why don't you take my virgin daughters instead? Now, I mean, that's repulsive. And so here you have somebody who is acting in a clearly reprehensible way. I mean, I can't even imagine as a father sacrificing my sons or daughters. Disgusting. And yet, that was the best that Sodom had to offer. And Yahweh saved him. And saved his daughters. Because that was the best Sodom had to offer. It's not that God is looking for perfect people, because there are no perfect people. Then you look at the individual Yahweh chose to reveal his Torah, Moshe. He was a murderer, for crying out loud. First, he was living a fraud. He was the son of a Hebrew slave. And the decree was to kill the boys because the Egyptians feared an uprising. And yet he was adopted into Pharaoh's family, living a lie. And one day watching his people be abused by the very political and religious establishment that he was part of, Moshe responded violently and killed one of the taskmasters. And then he fled. And so that was the individual that Yahweh chose to reveal his Torah. In fact, he was flawed even in his ability to speak. Evidently, he had a speech impediment of some sort, that his tongue is thick. And yet that was the individual that God said, I want you to reveal my name and my presence among my people. It shows you that Yahweh works with flawed individuals, saves flawed individuals, develops a relationship with flawed individuals. Why? Because there are no other types. So it's not our behavior and our adherence to the Torah's instructions that causes us to find favor with Yahweh. And then you look at David. Oh my goodness. I mean, he violated virtually every aspect of the Torah, except he was constantly willing to observe what God had to say, to listen to what God had to say, to think about what God had to say. He came to understand what God was offering, came to love Yahweh and his approach, embraced the terms and conditions of the covenant. And so the man who serves as the best example of how we should approach our relationship with God was in wholesale violation of the Torah. And therefore, the premise of Christianity, of Pauline Christianity, where God had to come up with a new plan because the old plan was ineffective, that no one could perform acceptably under the old plan, so he had to scrap the old plan and come up with a new plan. The very basis of Pauline Christianity is a complete and utter fraud. All you've got to do is listen to what these individuals have to say and to consider who they were. So, Larry, before I turn back to the 40th Psalm, what do you think about that? As a father, would you view Lot as a righteous dude for offering to sacrifice his daughters to those outside who wish to rape them?
No, I wouldn't.
No. No. You know, you'd rather die fighting them and keeping them at bay than you would sacrifice them.
And you'll have to excuse me. Go over the context of what we're talking about here again.
Well, what I wanted to point out, Larry, is that before we started reading the 40th Psalm, and we're only reading the 40th Psalm and considering Yahweh's testimony because I wanted to establish Yah's perspective on his covenant, so that when the Christians propose a new testament, a new covenant, that our listeners would understand that the Christian version, or the Christian replacement, is in wholesale conflict with God's testimony. The only way you can know that is to know God's testimony. The second is that when Paul proposes his new plan, his new gospel, his gospel of grace, and that salvation through faith, while demeaning the Torah as incompetent and mean and enslaving, The only way to know for certain that he is lying is to consider what God's impressions are, what God's perspective
is. That's a good idea.
Yeah, on his Torah.
That's a great idea.
And then I wanted folks beyond that to know that the basis of Pauline Christianity was that it was impossible for anyone to do everything that this Torah demands, and that a person who is guilty of one violation of the Torah would have no remedy and therefore would be destined to die, would be enslaved to that mean-spirited document. That notion, which then required for Pauline Christianity to prevail a whole different scheme, the basis of that, the foundation of his argument, is torn asunder by the fact that everyone, without exception, that Yahweh formed a relationship with, that he said was righteous, that he worked with, that he chose to be part of his covenant and family. Everyone of them.
Yeah, they fell down all over the place, including getting drunk and having incest with your daughters, as an example.
Like Lot. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Lot got drunk. He had incest with his daughters. This is a man who clearly violated the Torah's instructions, and yet Yahweh saved him.
You know, it, there's something else here, too, that I really want to point out. And that's that Yahweh tells us never, and this is never, to imitate the religious ways of the Goy.
The Gentiles, yeah, the Goy.
Now, that being the case, I don't know of a single religion that isn't involved in faith.
Right. They're all
faith-based. How would faith, for instance, when Islam talks, say, when this Islamic cleric talks a kid into putting on a suicide bomb or somebody of lesser intelligence, and they go in and blow up a wedding party or what have you with this vest they're wearing and they kill themselves, they have a lot of faith.
Oh, of course. If the faith of an Islamic jihadist is much greater than the faith of any Christian. There isn't a Christian on the planet whose faith is as great as a Islamic jihadist. And so if faith is what mattered, then we would be in very bad shape. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. Larry, you made a point that Yahweh consistently instructs us not to follow in the political and religious ways of the Goyim, of the Gentiles, particularly those surrounding Yisrael. And if you look at the nations, the Gentile nations surrounding Yisrael, the most influential religiously and politically was Babylon, then Assyria. And after Babylon and Assyria, you'd have Egypt. And later on, of course, Greece and Rome. But there's something that we are missing if we speak of those nations independently. And that is that religiously and politically, those nations were identical.
Yeah,
they all promoted exactly the same. Yeah, the religion was the same. The political structure, which was a blend of religion and politics, was the same. Men were promoted as gods. They were militaristic in nature. You know, they were like America today, where they're known most of all and had their influence because they had the biggest militaries in the world, larger than the rest of the countries typically combined.
Yeah, well, I mean, you had everything in Babylon. A lot of people fail to understand that was the most religious place on the planet.
Right.
You know, similar to, say, the Vatican today. You know, they took part in spiritualism and summoning spirits.
Of course.
In Easter and Christmas.
Of course. Yeah, Easter and Christmas were conceived in Babylon. Absolutely.
Yeah.
The Trinity is a Babylonian religious rite. Sunday worship, purely Babylonian.
Right.
Bel is the Lord. You know, calling God the Lord was conceived in Babylon. You know, virtually every major aspect of Christianity, the priesthood.
The cross.
Nuns.
It's never written as
the
cross.
The cross was conceived with
right one.
Right, with Tammuz.
Right pillar.
Even the Roman Catholic Lent, specifically conceived and practiced in Babylon.
You know,
Easter
was said to live 40 years, and then
right.
he was killed by a wild boar. So
right.
for 40 days, you abstained,
correct?
Deprived yourself, and then on day 40, you got to eat that Easter ham.
Yeah, right. and the Easter ham was part of the religious festival of Easter in Babylon, and it all surrounded too the Mother of God and the Queen of Heaven, which is another fundamentally Christian concept that was all part of the Babylonian religion. In fact, an essential part of the Babylonian religion. All of these concepts, by the way, migrated to Egypt, migrated from Egypt to Greece, and then from Greece to Rome. In fact, if you were to compare the cult of Dionysus to the Christian Jesus Christ, and then compare the Torah to the actual Yahusha, the Christian Jesus Christ is a much better fit for Dionysus, for Tammuz,
oh, yeah. sure.
for yeah, Osiris, yeah. than...
And Paul even takes the words of Dionysus, puts them in Yahusha's mouth on the road to Damascus, remember?
Of course.
He also, the story in Euripides where Dionysus, there's an earthquake, and he's freed from prison and the chains fall off.
Oh, I know.
That's Paul.
Applies it to himself.
Exact story. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. He's constantly quoting the plays that were based on Greek mythology. Why? Because he was trying to appeal to Greeks. So he wanted his deity to model the characteristics of the Greek deities. That's why he spouted Gnosticism. You know, he was in the Socrates and Plato mindset. But all of these things are religious practices that are denounced. You know, for example, in Yirmiyah, God specifically says, don't cut down an evergreen tree and bring it into your home and stand it up and then decorate it with the ornaments of silver and gold. Don't do that. It's offensive to me. It's stupid. And what is the symbol of Christmas? And with the evergreen tree decorated into the home. Oh, Christmas tree, oh, Christmas tree. The Astarte worship, and particularly the Astarte pole, all a celebration of Easter. God says, don't do that. Don't show reverence for this Queen of Heaven and Mother of God. There is no such thing. Christianity is nothing but an amalgamation of pagan religions, replete with the Trinity, replete with calling God the Lord, replete with the Jesus Christ. It's the very thing God said don't do.
In front of the oldest satanic symbol in the world, the Christ, the cross on
correct.
Sunday.
Right. And the cross was developed first because of Tammuz, and Tammuz's name, the big T, was the first issue of the cross. And then when the Queen of Heaven and Mother of God, after his death, the death of then the king, claimed that she had been impregnated by the sun so that she could give rise to the son of the sun. We'll be back in a moment. It is amazing that Christians in particular think that their religion is godly, that it was sponsored by God, that God has a church, and that God will work through and protect his church. But even in church, it's a completely pagan term.
Yeah, that's the daughter of Helios, the sun god, Sersh.
Yeah, exactly.
You have, in Yahweh's talking, he says, I am Yahweh, this is my name, my renown and manifestation of power. I will not give to another,
right,
or my renown reputation to religious imagery.
Right.
We find that in every church.
Right. That's why you can't have a Jesus Christ. He's not giving his renown, reputation to another. You can have a Yahusha because Yahusha isn't a different name. The same name. It's the name attached to a verb. It's Yahweh saving. So you can have a Messiah because it's not a new name. It's the same name attached to a verb. Yahweh working in our presence. No, you can't have a Jesus, you can't have a Christ, you can't have a Jesus Christ, you can't have a Lord, you can't have an Allah. Not when you know for certain that Yahweh is God. He not only proclaims that Yahweh is his name and that he is God, he proves it. You know, it's not about you and I asserting that he is God like Muslims will assert that Allah is God. Yahweh proves that he's God. And he proves that he's God through countless accurate prophecies, thousands upon thousands of them, that he has recorded in our past that have come true before our eyes.
You know, it's
always right.
An interesting one of the kind of mind blowing things is that let's say Yada's over here in one century writing something, and Larry's over here in another 200 years later writing something, and you know, they look at these writings and they go, these are prophetic, they are true, they match Yahweh's words, and they all come together in this Tanakh, this covenant writings, and then we find Yahweh's name exactly 7,000 times.
Yeah, in those combined books.
We find they were
all conveying exactly the same message.
Yeah, then we've got
thousands of prophecies. You know, the best prophet that we have apart from Yahweh would probably be Nostradamus. He didn't make a single prophecy that was specific, not one. He was as likely to get them right as he was to get them wrong. And here's Yahweh.
You have to jump through those hoops called quantrails, is that what
it's yes, called? Yes, yes. And only
you
look
have
at
to
them.
See something that isn't there, kind of.
Right. No one has ever taken one of them and predicted what's going to happen accurately. They've only looked at what has happened and said, well, you know, if you smush this together and you take out that and you pull this from context, and, well, that might be this. You know? And here's Yahweh telling us exactly what's going to happen. Who's going to do what to whom and when, and how he is going to act in human history. And everything that he says is precisely accurate. You know, even in ancient history, we don't have, apart from the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, mankind does not have an accurate record of human history. If you read the hieroglyphics that are in the temples in Egypt, they're hugely distorted. They're so distorted you can't put together an accurate timeline of the pharaohs because everybody exaggerated everything. You look at the history of Rome, you know, the Rome, oh, mighty Rome. Well, the historians in Rome were relativists. They created a mythological history to promote their culture. Man does not have any accurate ancient histories other than the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, and they are precisely accurate.
You know, one of the things I was going to point out is the sevens, amazingly, because you end up with 77 words that comprise his statements that they call the Ten Commandments. Mm-hmm. His name 7,000 times. You got seven Moed Mikra. You got a seventh day of rest.
Mm-hmm.
You've got seven lights on a menorah.
Right.
All this comes together just so magically.
The seven spirits of Yahweh. Yeah, everything is about seven, and you wonder, okay, how is that? Do we have a pattern here? And the 7 days of creation, and what it all leads to is a very
seven bowls of wrath.
Right, you know? Right. Consistent formulas. You know, seven open letters in Revelation, seven vials. It's all a pattern of seven, and it's a pattern of seven for a reason. That's Yahweh's formula.
You look at that mitzvah, those seven Moed Mikra, and instead of he set up a family covenant, and I'd put it like this. People say, what religion are you? Well, I'm of no religion. In fact, I try to dissuade people from religion. And if they said, well, what's your last name? And I said, well, it's Hendrix, used to be Hendrix Meyer. Then they would sit there and say, oh, they wouldn't ask what religion we are. They might ask how many brothers and sisters you got. Well, Yahweh set up a family covenant. And those Moed Mikra, that seventh day of rest, is so that Yahweh will get to know you while you're getting to know him through his words. And
correct.
Once you get to know somebody, that changes the way you view them.
Correct.
And that's what this is really all about.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, we're not trying to convince anybody to believe Yahweh. We're not trying to prove that Yahweh exists. Yahweh proved that he exists. If you want to know him, if you want absolute proof, if you're an agnostic and you don't think that there is any way to know for certain if there's a God or if there's a God, who God might be, what he's like and what he wants, then read the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. He not only introduces himself, he proves that he's God through these constant...
I tell them to go to yadayah.com and start right. reading that so they don't think that what they're reading in a Bible is anywhere near accurate. Because
yeah.
you've got to come out of those religious words.
You do.
You've got to come
you
to
do.
It, yeah. it, what he was saying. Once you understand what he's saying, you understand this is all real.
Right.
I mean,
yeah, and it's,
why.
And it's helpful to have somebody kind of hold your hand along the way. Once
yeah.
you've done that, then you can go off on your own and explore as you wish. But you know, a great example at yadayah.com. It begins
3,000 pages of extant study, the
right.
best study on the planet, I'll add.
Yeah, to tell you exactly who Yahweh is, to prove he exists. In fact, Yadayah was written to demonstrate that Yahweh proved that, that he exists. The thing that just strikes you right at the beginning is when you accurately translate the opening creation account in the Torah, rather than being opposed to science, rather than being in conflict with science, it precedes science by thousands of years.
You mean when he talks about the Big Bang?
He calls it. He calls creation the Big Bang. He talks about the order of life and how life emerged as plant life and then how animal life followed plant life and how all life came out of the oceans and then onto the land and has the
and
right
he did
order.
Not say he and he did not say the sun. Sun
no.
was created on the fourth day. He creates nothing on the fourth day. He said it becomes visible.
Correct.
And then in the fourth millennium, man, you know, we
the, and the reason that he talks the about the sun becoming visible on the fourth day is not only because that's what actually occurred. The as you look through the eras of the development of our planet, we had a period where the sky was completely opaque. Because of the constant bombardment of asteroids and the volcanoes and the like. And finally, when those started stopped bombarding us and the oceans cooled and plant life emerged, it could filter the carbon dioxide and produce oxygen in the atmosphere clear. So he's giving us the right order of things precisely as it occurred, but it's more than that. Because the creation account is three stories in one. And one of those three stories happens to be the story of his means to redeem us, to resolve the issues that would separate us. And the fourth day is about the greater light, Yahweh, in the form of Yahusha, coming in the 4,000 year, the fourth millennia of human history, which would be year 4,000 Yah, 33 CE in our pagan calendars, and fulfilling the first four moed, which were acknowledged on the fourth day because the greater light became a sign for the moed, and fulfilling the first four moed in the fourth millennia of human history, specifically so that we might be able to meet with God. And you put this together and you say, wow, that's pretty amazing to weave into the story. But I think the most amazing of all is this the realization that the entire creative process from the perspective of the Creator at creation took exactly 6 24-hour days, which is exactly the same as 14 billion years looking back from our perspective here on Earth. And the reason we...
General relativity.
Correct. And the reason we know that is because of the... is that we're able to measure the cosmic microwave radiation that is still glowing in the universe at the time of the Big Bang. Now, the Big Bang was not when the universe was created. That is a myth. The Big Bang is when light energy was dissipated and cooled to the point that energy could coalesce into matter. Time only matters when there is matter. Devoid of matter, there is no reference to time. So the Big Bang is the beginning of time when the creative process of the universe transitioned from purely energy to energy and matter. And if you recognize that the wavelength of the cosmic radiation from the Big Bang is stretched 10 to the 12th power, all you do is multiply 6 24-hour days times 365 and a quarter years times 14 billion years and divide that by 10 to the 12th. And guess what you come up with?
6 24-hour days.
Yeah. Yeah. And once you've done that, once you realize that 6 24-hour days from the perspective of the Creator at creation is exactly what we measure today. Exactly. And you don't recognize that, okay, well, that's pretty impressive. That's,
you know,
hard.
That woke me up.
Yeah, that's really hard to say, well, Moshe fella, he was a really good guesser. No, at that point, you pretty much need to deal with what the author of that book had to say. There are so many reasons to consider the Torah prophets and Psalms. And while the accuracy of the creation account is one of them, Larry, I'm very impressed with the accuracy of the flood account. I mean, the flood account is the, along with the creation account, are the two things that atheists use to besmirch the quote-unquote Bible. We know that's not an accurate term. And they will always say that life, you know, spontaneously came to exist. It was not created. And yet, even when they found that DNA was a language, you know, DNA is not just a language with an alphabet. It's a three-dimensional language. And even when they found out that DNA was a language, they still said, oh, yeah, that random chance. Even when they found the Cambrian explosion, where every one of the 30-some-odd basic animal life forms, every single one, was created all at once in one instant, and that that there is absolute proof that animal life forms did not evolve one to the other. They all came into existence at the same time, and there hasn't been a single unique animal form since the Cambrian explosion. And even in, and with all of that evidence, they cling to the lie. But they,
how about,
of course,
this one?
Yes.
How about this one? Just let me share this. This is just lovely. This is Dead Sea Scrolls. Zachariah says this on, and he's talking about a battle 19 years in our future, according to Yahweh's Yobel.
Yeah.
In this day, declared prophetically, Yahweh declared prophetically, I will strike every fast-moving flying weapon of war and confuse the drivers, causing them to be irrational.
Right.
Now, he's talking about the battle of Mogidon, Armageddon.
Yeah. Right.
So there we go. He's talking about planes with drivers, and he wrote that. He dated it the 8th month of the 2nd year of King Darius of Persia, meaning it was 520 BCE.
Right. Matter of fact, the same prophets speak of nuclear holocaust, talk about elements melting with intense heat.
Yeah.
He says that in the middle, exact middle of the tribulation, that an asteroid named Apophis is going to strike the Earth. And we find that it was discovered. Well, the asteroid, we predicted it, of course, and named it and timed it right around 90 CE. And it wasn't, the actual asteroid wasn't discovered, which, by the way, is named Apophis, which, by the way, is going to come within the satellite ring of the Earth, just miles from our surface, is if it's not nudged. And Yahweh says it's going to be nudged. April 13th, a Friday, in 2029, exactly when he said it was going to strike.
That's right. And in your Bibles, that'll say wormwood.
Right. Yeah, but it's a purpose.
If you're using Hebrew or Aramaic Bashura or whatever, you're going to see it says Wormwood, because those are books that are just copied off the Texas Receptus and put back into the language to trick you to think you have something old when you don't.
Or you look at Yashaya, and he's talking about how in the last battles before his return, he speaks specifically of a war being waged by terrorists that ultimately turns Damascus into a twisted heap of rubble and brings down greater Syria, which would be Syria and western Iraq. And that how that war ultimately leads to a treaty that fends Israel at the waist. This was at a time that Israel didn't exist. And now we look at Israel.
Bank.
Right. And the West Bank will be sacrificed, as was Gaza, thinning Israel to within 10 miles wide at its where 70% of the people live. And it says immediately after that jihadists, Muslim terrorists, are going to flood into Israel by the hundreds of thousands, by the millions.
It's amazing that people don't see it. We're watching it. He said, in this last generation, this is exactly what would happen. And we're watching it.
How much of that do you have to see? How much of it do you have to read before you say, you know, I just don't think that all of these fellows were precisely accurate guessers. The author of this, the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, lives outside of the constraints of time and has reported future history and our past so that we might know and trust him.